Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gift. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome to New Books in Education. I'm Hoover Harris, editor of DegreeOrNotDegree.com, and with me today is Dr. Alex Bentley, who is a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Tennessee. He's here to discuss his book, The Acceleration of Cultural Change, From Ancestors to Algorithms, which he co-authored with Michael O'Brien, who is the provost at Texas A&M San Antonio. Alex, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the book, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I'm a professor of anthropology at University of Tennessee and here in Knoxville. I live in Knoxville. But I spent a good part of my adult life and my career in England. My first job was at University College London, and then I moved up to an anthropology department up at Durham University, up in the northeast of England. And I finished actually as a professor and department head at University of Bristol as the chair of the archaeology and anthropology department there. So it's really good to be back in the United States. I'm originally from Wisconsin, and it's fantastic to be living in Tennessee. Our department here in Tennessee is known a lot for its forensic science and the so-called body farm. So I'm enjoying that as well.
What types of archaeological projects have you engaged in the past?
The first big dig I went on, I learned to dig from somebody right here at Knoxville in 1993. It was Thomas Jefferson's Poplar Forest. I joined a summer school there as an archaeologist. I've been out to a huge kind of 1930s ancient civilization site called Harappa in the Indus Valley on the Indian subcontinent. And I spoke Hindi-Urdu while I was there in 1999. And, you know, massive digs of many stories high and people passing huge containers of soil hand in hand to each other to get out what we were excavating. Then later I specialized actually in the early farming period called the Neolithic of Europe, about 5000 BC, when people were just starting to cultivate crops and herd domestic animals and live in villages rather than hunt and gather. So that's my archaeology is focused mainly on skeletons and measuring chemicals in the skeletons that are indicative of diet and migration and so on.
Wow. Very interesting. Well, the book is very interesting. Again, the main title is The Acceleration of Cultural Change. It's a fairly short book, but it's very broad at the same time. There's an incredible number of subjects and topics crammed in every page, it seems. Let's start, I suppose, with why you wrote it. You co-wrote it with Michael O'Brien. You might want to tell us a little bit about him, too. What prompted you two to partner and write about this subject?
Mike O'Brien is also an archaeologist, but his specialty is North America. But he and I met because we were both interested in this new field called cultural evolution, which was pretty new about 15 years ago. And now it has a big annual conference and everything. It's even a dedicated center in Germany called the Max Planck Center. But Mike O'Brien was dean of arts and science at University of Missouri for 10 years, and he and I met at a conference about culture evolution, and we really hit it off, and we're very good friends now. We see each other, our families see each other over the holidays and so on, but we love to collaborate with each other. And what we have in common was to think about how culture changes in traditional society. So how did culture change in 5000 BC in the Neolithic of Europe? Or how did it change among the first hunter-gatherers of North America? And what can we learn from traditional anthropology about that? And so in our field, our examples and our thinking is a lot about social learning, how people learn their skills for hunting or for cultivating crops from each other, from an expert in the community, and in small groups. And in thinking a lot about those kinds of subjects, I think what has struck me over the last 15 years is how different that kind of traditional learning, learning by apprenticeship, learning a craft, learning how to make a stone tool from somebody who has made it for decades, and then you will teach your child how to make that same stone tool and so on. And thinking about how different that is from pop culture, from the exponential growth in technology, from social media, and all that we have come to internalize is almost seeming normal about our lives and constant flux and change. This was not even remotely the norm in the past. Change was not remotely the norm. And that's, I think, what prompted us to write this book together, was the difference between, say, the last 30,000 years of human existence versus the last 10 years being very different from each other.
You have a great way of describing that difference in the preface. I would call it your main thesis, or you call it your central premise. Let me just read this and I'll ask you to elaborate on it. You've already started to explain this, but you write, "Our central premise is that the shape of cultural transmission has changed dramatically over recent decades from one that is thin and deep to one that is shallow and broad." Can you explain the difference in what you mean by thin and deep versus shallow and broad?
So thin and deep, I mean that by thin is, I mean thin in terms of population. So people will have lived in small communities, maybe villages of 30 or 100 people, probably more like 30. And they learned traditions that had been passed down to them from previous generations and previous generations, and traditions and ways of doing things that were typically so old, you would have no consciousness of change. A couple of examples are folk tales. There are folk tales that we know, like Little Red Riding Hood or Grimm's fairy tales and the like, which are thousands of years old. They were retold from parents to children for thousands of years and changed very little. They spread across the Eurasian continent from, you know, Eastern Asia all the way to Western Europe. And they're recognizably, they're similar across the continent, thousands of years old. When we look at in archaeological villages, like one called Çatalhöyük in modern-day Turkey, one of the first villages of farming communities about 8,000 years ago, people lived in mud brick houses on top of each other. They buried their relatives under the kitchen floor, and They replastered their walls, hundreds of times in their lifetime, and they just herded sheep and goats and cultivated lentils. And to them, change would, they just would have no conception of change the way we do, as you just do things as you do them. I mean, with the exception of, well, we replastered the wall for our seventh time this year. That's the extent of change, or maybe there were marriages and so on. So that's long and thin. And the other thing about long and thin is we're conscious of who is the expert on what in our community. So I have anthropologists, colleagues who work out on the islands of Fiji in the South Pacific, and they ask people, who is the expert in a small traditional village? Who's the expert on yam cultivation in your village? And they name one of the women in their village. Who's the best fisherman? Who would you ask about fishing, spear fishing? And they all pretty much point to the same person or a couple of people. Experts well understood and known personally. So now think about the modern online world that we all live in. It's very wide and fat. Many of the things that we discuss are yesterday's news, and we all know that, or the things about very recent changes that are very recent, and they're global. And so we're so often talking about global changes that are very rapid, within the last week or day or year, and they're worldwide, or at least countrywide. And that's really the essential difference between long and thin and short and wide.
So with the long and thin, the long and deep, there's a consistency in patterns and meaning, a slowness, a deep slowness in change. There are distinct authorities. There's very slow, deliberate transmission of cultural patterns. And we're basically losing all of that now. Is that the point?
Yeah. And, one of the advantages of the long and thin pattern in human history and prehistory was that the culture had a chance to sort of fine tune itself to the needs of the society as this change was so slow. So we have an example that we use in the book, the Acheulean hand axe. That was a stone tool that it's actually dates back to pre-humans. It dates back to Homo erectus. That stone tool persisted without changing much for over a million years. And that's because it was so adaptive. It was so useful for presumably cutting carcasses, for cutting other wood and other materials. And just it was sort of a prehistoric jackknife, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And the change was so slow that tool had a chance to optimize for the needs of the hominids that were using it. And, we see the same thing in the kinds of technologies people used for early farming and hunting and gathering. They're pretty much optimal for the purposes that people have had. But now change is so fast that you wonder, and I'm sure a lot of people wonder, if what we're doing is really optimal or even really solving problems the way that culture used to do. Culture, one of the purposes of culture has been for human beings, it's the secret to our success because it solves problems for us. And it solves problems for us because we inherit the wisdom of many, many, many generations over time, which have been trying to solve problems, farm the land or adjust to an environment, subsist and survive, cooperate, those kinds of things. Those are ways that culture solves problems for us. And if it's changing so fast, and if it's not local, then it might be very difficult for our cultural decisions to solve our problems.
You mentioned the endurance of certain fables such as Little Red Riding Hood. And I was amazed when I read the book to see how old that is, thousands of years old, as you say. I wonder what conclusions you draw when you look at fables like that and their persistence. And as you explain in the book, the consistency of that particular narrative pattern across cultures. As an anthropologist, what do you conclude when you see the persistence and prevalence of these certain fables, what does that tell you about cultural transmission and how humans pass on important knowledge?
What it tells you is it gives you a clue about what about the differential survival of aspects of culture. So you can imagine over those thousands of years, people inventing new components to the story, little local variations. And a lot of those local variations just never survive past the next generation. And over time, the process of, telling these stories to your children, and your children need to find them interesting, or you're never going to tell them again. So the children are sort of doing the selecting by being attentive or not, and that separates the wheat from the chaff over time. And so we find, it was a colleague of mine who did that study. You find that certain elements persist very well over time, like people like minimally counterintuitive aspects to a story, things that are somewhat surprising but not outlandish or ridiculous. And you know, there are aspects to Little Red Riding Hood that are like that, like the excavating the grandmother out of the wolf's belly, for example. I had an idea related to this. There's a kind of branch of experimental cultural science called transmission chains, where they give a message to somebody and say, okay, you tell this message to the next person. It's like Chinese whispers, telephone. Mm-hmm. You tell this message to somebody, and they tell it to somebody, and then they tell it to somebody. And what you see is by the end of this game of telephone, the message that makes it to the other side, let's say it's eight people, are the really salient aspects of that message. And so I always thought it would be a kind of a fun way to do, to generate advertisements. If somebody had like a jingle or a slogan or something, I'd just send it through one of those message chains and see what come out the other side. And I'd say, okay, this is the best part of your message, whatever got retained in that game of telephone. But culture, those folk tales have done the same thing. So imagine when you're telling your children the Little Red Riding Hood story, you can appreciate that these are elements of that folk tale that have made it through hundreds of generations of retelling since prehistoric times.
So they've survived the telephone game on a large scale, in a sense.
Yeah, and I wanted to draw a distinction. Yeah, they do, and some of my colleagues call these elements attractors. They keep the kind of common elements that you might know you know about as well as I do, Hoover. That there are many common plot elements to stories that make them successful, and those are sort of vetted by generations after generations. But I did want to draw a distinction between something like a folktale, which is static, to something that builds over time, like technology. Mm-hmm. And that's a different animal, because obviously technologies don't just remain static for hundreds of thousands of years. They build over time. And that's something that's hit such a stage of acceleration now that we're going to have to come up with new ways of keeping up. And I do have some examples of that.
Yeah, maybe before we get to those examples, we should go back to your hand axe just to make that a counterpoint. And I'm curious as to why it stayed the same for, what did you say, a million years, hundreds of thousands of years? So just for the listeners, if they don't know, if they missed this class, the Acheulean hand axe is an oblong rock that fits in your hand that you or I could probably nap in our backyards in a few hours with some practice, right? It's a simple tool.
Yeah.
And it remained the same for many, many generations and many, many cultures, as I understand it. Why didn't that evolve more? Why didn't somebody add a wooden handle or whatever? Why did this thing persist for so long in its basic form?
Well, the first reason is that it's a pretty kind of optimal shape. Like, think about things that haven't really evolved much, like a hammer, or a pair of pliers, or a garlic press. People come up with newfangled ones, and you give them to people for Christmas, and nobody ever uses them because you can't improve upon it. I think actually that's one thing about the Acheulean hand axe. But the other thing is, the Acheulean hand axe is from about 1.4 million years ago to several hundred thousand years ago. And we actually go through a progression of even of pre-human species during that time. But what happens for human cultural evolution after that is we start to get the ability to cumulatively build on our technology. So instead of, you know, you mentioned a wooden handle, well, things like the bow and arrow or projectile points, arrow points that have a wooden, you know, are hafted onto a piece of wood, you know, to be shot as a javelin or thrown as a javelin or shot as a bow. And then later, you know, tools that have multiple parts to them. Once that starts happening, then we get into a process where parts of tools of technology can then be used to assemble other technologies. And that's continued to this day. You know, economists write about how a car, for example, is just contains a whole number of other inventions that used to be standalone inventions, and technology just keeps is a recombination of previous technologies and building on that. So that was a crucial transition time for human beings when we actually started to accumulate culture over time rather than just replicating it from one generation to the next. And so that's why the Acheulean hand axe, I think, was so long lived. But then we enter a period where we can start to combine technologies and make more complex technologies, and that becomes a progressive process that's also prone to acceleration, because it's kind of like a doubling kind of effect. You know, once you put two and two together, then you're putting two pairs together for four, and you know, there's an acceleration to that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, so you anticipated my next question. I was about to ask if this compounding of technologies creates an exponential change effect, and you're saying it does. So if we imagine a chart during the hand axe phase, it's pretty flat, but as these technologies compound, we start to slope upwards, and I guess we're on that steep vertical slope now. Is that an accurate way to describe your thinking?
That's right. There's an economist named Eric Beinhacker who used to show a plot just like that, and it's the time scale is like 2 million years or something, and he's counting the number of SKUs, shopping units, you know, the number of different, and he talks about, or the number of tools that we have or different objects that we have in our life. And so he kind of estimates for hunter-gatherers 2 million years ago, I don't know, 10, maybe a dozen. And then you think about the typical Walmart these days has like 700,000 SKUs or something. And it's just a crazy curve. It actually looks like it just goes straight up in the last 2,000 years. And it's a great diagram that shows the kind of not only that acceleration of technology, but the overload that we experience now. You know, you think about, well, what used to sort out the needs that we had? Well, we would teach them to our children. But now and for a long time, obviously there's no one person who is in command of even a tiny portion of the technology that he or she uses on a daily basis. And that's another key to this transition, because it's also happening now in our social lives or in our cultural lives. Our parents and their parents, we've long lived in a world where no one person or even a group of people could command the technology that we use in our daily lives. But they could probably command their social engagements. But now we have people with Twitter accounts that have, maybe thousands of followers. That's not something that a human being could have ever maintained before that technology made possible.
Well, you've already given a couple of modern examples, and you said you wanted to cite some other examples. So let's talk about those. And one thing I love about the book, by the way, is the number of examples in it.
Yeah, thank you. We love to go through these examples because one of the main themes is the diversification of cultural knowledge has undergone one of these exponential curves. And an exponential curve is very slow until suddenly it becomes very fast, or it feels very sudden. Once the doubling is actually like about the size of what you thought you knew before. Here's one example. Scientific publishing is one example. There are, in the old days of science, we think of individuals like Marie Curie or Darwin or Einstein and so on, and writing I remember the days when you wrote an academic paper, you put it in an envelope and you sent it to a journal, and then they would send it out by mail to some reviewers and so on. Now we do all this online, and there are about 2.5 million scientific papers published every year. And even in a subfield, even if you're an archaeologist or a nuclear physicist or a doctor, you can't command all of the scientific literature that's being published on your subject, even if it's very narrow. And another example of the exponential nature of this is there are a lot of these open access journals. And they publish scientific papers, and you don't need a subscription to go look at them. Like, one of these journals is called PLOS One, Public Library of Science One. In 2007, they published about 1,200 papers. That's quite a bit. That's 100 papers a month. But in recent years, it's well over 20,000 papers. Wow. A year. That's just one journal, and there are now about 30,000 peer-reviewed academic journals. Those are the journals, not the papers. And it's grown exponentially. Like I said, from 1,200 in 2007 to 20,000 in maybe 2017, so 10 years for one journal. It's grown exponentially, and it's diversified to an extent where there's a journal on almost every subject. I used to laugh because there was a journal of happiness studies, but that's not even close to how obscure the journals get nowadays. 30,000 of them. And that has a couple of effects. One is that we all, I have a friend in genetics who he has an algorithm, like a Twitter bot, actually just read, scan journal articles for him, and it'll retweet the ones that fall within his interest, that has the keywords that he's looking for. And then the other thing is that we're all now hyper focused on single, the highest ranked journals like Science or Nature. There's one called Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and everybody's focused on those because we're sort of assuming that the best science will get to the top. And in a way, that is like us trying to look for the experts. Like, remember I mentioned out on the Fijian islands, who's the best fisherman? Oh, he is. Who's the best yam cultivator? Oh, she knows everything about yams. And we're all trying to do that. And the shortcut we take is we look to central hubs of information, like a big prestigious science journal, or maybe we have our preferred media site or media purveyor or something like that. And so ironically, given all the diversity there is out there, one of the things we see is that people are actually more and more focused towards massive central hubs of information as opposed to getting local knowledge from around themselves. And again, this is another thing that's reinforcing that wide and shallow aspect of cultural change now rather than thin and narrow.
So we're flooded with minutia and almost infinite amounts of knowledge, but you still see a craving and that human tendency to go back to core knowledge and core principles.
Yeah, and a craving to have some kind of expert to follow. But the problem is we don't know who the experts are anymore. We want to trust an expert, but you know, how many pieces of phishing spam do you get in your email box at somebody professing to be an expert? There are all sorts of reasons why it's so very difficult to recognize true expertise. I won't mention the words fake news in this interview but what that is an expression of people, you know, we don't know whom to trust. We don't know who is the expert. And that's not just a momentary aspect of our political climate right now. That's an aspect of information overload and us not having, it's not like we live in a village with these people, with people we call experts for most of our lives. Or that we're inheriting information that we trust because it is what we do. We don't even question it. We're now having to be critical about just about everything that comes across our desk because it comes from people we don't know and places or centers we've never been to, and we don't have any basis to judge whether something is good or bad. And there was a study last year, I think after we published this book, there was a study that showed that false messages on Twitter spread much farther and faster than true information spreads on Twitter. You know, it gets shared very rapidly. And that's something we should think about for our times, because that's nothing prehistoric people would hardly understand that except when they were gossiping.
Mm-hmm. And while we're framing this problem, let's talk about Dunbar's number for a moment. And you were just mentioning Twitter and social media where you're connected to thousands of people. What is Dunbar's number and what does that tell us about how our minds work and our capacity to interact with other people?
So Robin Dunbar, who's an anthropologist at Oxford University in England, in the 1990s, he was actually trying to figure out how big were early hominid prehuman social groups, and he found this relationship among primates, of which these hominids are part. In the primate kingdom, there's a relationship between the size of the social group, how many friends and can you associate with, and the size of the brain. It's actually the size of the neocortex portion of the brain. And he took, what he's trying to do is we want to figure out from, you know, all you get in paleoanthropology is the brain size, the number of cubic centimeters in the brain. And he was trying to equate that cubic centimeter measurement with group size in the past. And he used this relationship that he developed by looking at primates and saw that the larger the brain, the larger the social group of the primates, you know, baboons and macaques and gorillas. And then he just extrapolated it out to the brain size of prehistoric hominids, like let's say 900 cubic centimeters, or for humans, it's, 1,200 cubic centimeters or so, and even more so for Neanderthals. And then he was able to make an estimate. And that estimate, once you get to our brain size, is about 150 individuals that we're capable of handling as our social relationships based on the size of our brains. And the reason that's so cool And so interesting is that that's all he was trying to do, is just get some relationship between brain size and group size hundreds of thousands of years ago. But so his number is 150, and a recent study by Pew shows that the average, at least as of 2015, the average person has about 145, 150 friends on Facebook. The average Twitter.
That's great.
Instagram has about 145, 150 followers, something like that. It's just incredible. Who would have thought that 25 years ago, this number would predict how many followers we have on Facebook? But of course, a lot of people have 100,000 times that many followers. And that means that we're not talking about relationships anymore, social media connections, if they're in those kinds of numbers. They're not relationships. And so what are we actually doing on social media? Should we even call it social media if it's not predicated on relationships?
So we have a good sense of what our capacity really is as far as interacting with others. We've come a long way from having a few key stories told by the wise man chanting around the fire. We've come a long way from having to learn how to use 5 or 10 tools in our lifetimes and passing those down and the technical knowledge that goes with those. We're surrounded by compounding technologies, rapidly changing information, an abundance of journals and science and knowledge. So all that leads to the big question of can we as humans handle this? Is all of this necessarily a bad thing? And then the other big question I think is, what can we do about it if it is a bad thing?
Well, I think we're going to need help from artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So there's my friend.
Siri will save us.
Yeah, I hope so. Because the basic problem is that we don't have, with information overload, you can't separate the wheat from the chaff. How do you know good science from bad science when there's, 2,000 papers that are in your field that you're supposed to read or about any given subject? I have a friend who he programmed a Twitter bot, but all the Twitter bot does is retweet articles that are of interest to him. We need to do more. And one of the things I like to think about, the vast majority of scientific papers never get cited even once. Citing means, somebody else writes a paper and then puts that paper in the bibliography. Most scientific papers never get cited. And some scientific papers get cited tens of thousands of times. So it's very, it's a very unequal relationship. But that has a lot to do with human beings only being able to handle so much. And so they focus, they look at what other people are focusing on, and we focus on the same things. Ooh, that paper got cited. Ooh, I'm going to read it too, and I'll probably cite it. And there's a preferential advantage to popularity. What becomes popular tends to become even more popular. But AI doesn't have to read papers that way. AI, and I have colleagues who use computers to read papers and understand what the hypothesis is in the paper. Let's say it's about a reaction, a chemical reaction, or a biochemical process in the body, and they can say, 10 papers favor this hypothesis and only one falsifies it, so probably the hypothesis is true. And the AI will just keep going like that and reading papers and creating kind of a web of hypotheses and whether it supports one relationship or another. And so what AI can do is reestablish a form of selection on our knowledge and help to separate the wheat from the chaff again. Whereas human beings are stuck, just the tip of the iceberg, and also just relying a lot on copying other people to understand what's important or what's true. And AI doesn't have to do that. It also has the capacity to read through thousands or the millions of papers that are produced and test them against each other. And I think that's actually going to be necessary to deal with the the literally millions of scientific papers that are produced per year, or the 20,000 children's books that are printed every year. And yet, you know, we still tell our children Little Red Riding Hood, a lot of us do, mm-hmm. even though there's so much to choose from.
It's nice to hear someone speak positively about AI for once. Usually when we hear about AI, it's in the context of how long before we're all submitting to our robot overlords. But you're giving good examples of how this could actually be a tool, a modern day hand axe to help us get through our daily activities. And I think in the book, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you hinted there could even be a deceleration at some point. There might be a contraction in response to this acceleration and expansion. Is that a possibility?
Yeah. And there's already the one counterintuitive aspect about this acceleration of cultural change is the acceleration occurs when things can combine and then combine and then bigger pieces can combine, that sort of exponential change that we've been talking about. But what is at the top of the pop chart, shall we say? We talked about things that don't combine, like Little Red Riding Hood, or take the example of baby names or pop songs, or, you know, pop songs don't get any bigger. Or they don't get any more complex, arguably. The names we give our children, or the clothes we wear, things like this, they don't get more and more complex. And with those things, which I think about as more popular culture, the change isn't really accelerating. You know, if you look at how many baby names came through the top 10 in the last decade, it'd be fairly similar to the number of baby names that went through the top 10 in the 1950s, maybe a little bit higher, but not like this kind of exponential change that we're talking about. So in some ways, the popular culture or in artistic culture, if you're focused on, especially if you're focused on the top end of the popularity scale, the change isn't really going to accelerate that much. If we integrate when we talk about the other kinds of aspects that are growing exponentially, like knowledge and science and published knowledge and technology and so on, when we start to incorporate AI technologies that help us sort through all that, I think there'll be a deceleration of our perception of change as well, because if we acquire the ability to better select the best, the best things that are being invented, then we're focused on those, and the rate of change in terms of the very best is going to be much slower than the rate of change we feel when we're just deluged with everything.
I'm thinking of how on my phone, of course, we can now combine all of our multiple email accounts into one location and one feed. And then beyond that, I know with the Outlook app, for example, it gets smart about how you interact with it, and it separates the chaff from the wheat. And it's not, I guess that's AI of a sort, but that just came to mind as you were describing this coalescing of information. It's a silly example, but.
No, that's a great example, because one of the ways that a lot of social scientists are aggregating information is doing just that. So, for example, a good predictor of the rate of heart disease or heart attacks in a county, in a U.S. county, is actually the mm-hmm. frequency of hostile words used on Twitter in that county. Researchers can go through and look at, you know, they just have a list of words that connote hostility. That you just get that off the shelf, so to speak, and you just count through the tweets that have locations on them, and just count the differences in how much these hostile words are used by county. It turns out this predicts heart disease as well as any other kinds of health statistics that are out there. The hostility words on Twitter. And that's an example of looking for aggregate patterns in a huge volume of data. We're talking about obviously tens of millions of tweets in a study like that, which would make no sense to you if you're looking at them really granularly. But if you look at them in an aggregate sense, you can come up with very sensible and simple kinds of insights that that pull out the information that resides in that huge mass of data.
That's fascinating. It used to be the full moon that was the warning, and now it's the Twitter verbiage patterns. That's just amazing.
It is. Yeah.
I want to ask you about education and how your research and what the implications are of your research on education. And really, I know you come at this as a professor who has daily obligations in the classroom, and you gave examples even in your own academic career of, I don't know, two or three decades, whatever it is, you've seen a lot of changes moving from snail mail with the journal process and so forth and the expansion of journal articles. You've got these poor young students who are in the midst of this peak acceleration, it seems, of cultural change and the thinness or the shallowness and the breadth, rather, of our modern cultural transmission. Are there any guidelines for your teaching or for implications for higher education or recommendations based on where we are in cultural evolution right now?
Well, I can speak from personal experience, really, mainly. One is that I still really believe in teaching in small groups, or small groups being a classroom in person. I believe that the best education is still had when you're present in the classroom with the professor. Now, I know a lot of people, their only way of maybe getting a degree is an online degree, and I'm not trying to say we shouldn't do that, but I do think the best kind of education is in the classroom with an instructor. But the other thing is that we're now at the point where there's intra-generational change in social media technology. So I asked my students, how many of you have younger siblings who use a different social media platform than you do? And most of them raised their hand. And that's, you know, we remember the old phrase, the medium is the message, I think it was. But the fact that siblings actually have different ways of communicating with their friends. And of course, every social media platform has a different set of algorithms for how they manipulate that communication or how they manipulate the information that comes in. So we have literally a difference in young people. They experience literally a difference in cultural transmission, not just from their parents' generation or my generation, but even from their own, even within their own generation. And they have to think very carefully about what to study and what careers to plan for. So I was teaching a class this year, and I said, you know, how any of you, there were a lot of pre-med students in the class, and I said, are any of you thinking about becoming a radiologist? And I'm not, maybe one or two raise their hand, but I said, you know, rethink that, because that's one of the, you know, recognizing the patterns from x-rays is one of the things that's probably going to be taken over by artificial intelligence pretty soon. So, you know, that's not a viable career. You're going to have to, and I really feel for them, because, you know, how can you be a sophomore or junior in college and having to think on the fly about how a technology might make what you've just been studying, you know, obsolete? It's a real challenge for them, but they do have to get in the habit of thinking about change and how to anticipate it, and also how to work with people with different skills like never before. So they may, if they want to be successful in a kind of a business or a startup, they're going to have to work with probably computer programmers or people and managers and people with a whole different set of skills. And they can't survive without that, in my opinion, because they will almost certainly be working on a team, no matter what they do. They'll be working on a team of people with a vast array of skills, and they have to learn to at least be able to communicate with people with very different skills so that the team can come together and produce something. And, you know, those are things that's hard to teach, but I think we ought to be committed to teaching that kind of interdisciplinary or interspecialism teamwork skill, and the ability to anticipate and prepare for technological change that'll make their career space different as they go. You know, they're going to have several careers probably in their lifetime. And that's mm-hmm. something that older people, and certainly my parents' generation, didn't have to worry about so much.
Very good. Well, before I let you go, I'd like to hear what you're planning on working on next. Do you have any other big projects or books or research in the works?
We have another book. We really like this MIT Press series, these sort of thin design technology, business and life series. So we're actually working on another one for next year called The Importance of Small Decisions. I've been working recently on trying to understand and predict how information spreads on Twitter. We've also been working a little bit on trying to recognize patterns of the spread of false information as opposed to true information on Twitter, without knowing necessarily whether it's false or true objectively. But does true information spread with a different pattern than false information? And we're using a lot of the insights that from things we discuss in this book.
That sounds very relevant. And we know a lot of executives at social media companies are wrestling with that right now. So good for you. Very timely. Well, I jotted down a list of some of the many diverse topics covered in this short book. We've already spoken about the Acheulean hand axe and Dunbar's number, but you also cover topics as diverse as Bayesian probability, Alvin Toffler, Will Ferrell, charitable giving, the Bantu dispersal, and there's several pages on Gilligan's Island, as well as lots of great vignettes from your job at the Middleton Theater, which I'll save for the reader. I don't want to spoil any of that. They're really comical. The book is The Acceleration of Cultural Change from Ancestors to Algorithms. I've been speaking with Dr. Alex Bentley. It's a great book. I recommend it to all of our listeners. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.